US President Trump visited China this week, but can the dealmaker actually get a deal in Beijing? In the UK, the ruling Labour Party suffered a resounding defeat in local elections. Is the UK becoming ungovernable? And Ukraine recently took out 40% of Russia's oil export capacity. So is the Ukraine war about to reach a conclusion? I want to remind everyone that you can find us all on the major social media platforms, where you can subscribe and never miss anything. So, John, let's jump into the first topic. What was the context of Trump's trip to China? Why did it take place?
Yeah, I hope you're doing well, Imran. I think it's been difficult to avoid Trump's trip to China. It's all over the news.
And I think it's hard to avoid Trump full stop, to be honest.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So the context of this trip was actually quite important. There's a lot of issues that need to be discussed, that they need to iron out. So trade, you've got tariffs, you've got AI, you've got rare earth elements, you've got Iran, and you've got Taiwan as well. So the shopping list of issues Trump went with was actually quite long. However, all of these issues, the trade war, the issues with AI, tariffs, this is a trade war that Trump launched against China. So the reason why these issues exist is because America and Trump started them. And this trade war is not going well with China. So that's why even this trip, the expectations weren't really high. And that's because Trump doesn't have much leverage, which I'm sure we're going to discuss. He's gone to China. He started a trade war on a whole host of areas. And in each of them, China has been able to push back and actually complicate Trump's agenda. So the context of this trip was there's a mess of Trump's creation, of his own making, and now he's gone to China to go and sort this out and try and iron it out.
Well, in this two-day trip, that's how long Trump was in China, what would you say was actually achieved?
So we're recording this on the Sunday. So, you know, we're about 2.5 days out from when the trip began. There's been no major announcements since he's got back. And I would even say, look, 2 days isn't really a long time to discuss the laundry list of issues that they had. And in those 2 days, you've got to take away the dinners. You've got to take away the tourist trips they made. You've got to take away where the teams of both countries got together. The actual sit down between Trump and Xi Jinping was probably just a couple of hours. You had a lot of pomp and ceremony, but what I'm seeing is very light outcomes when it comes to the diplomatic breakthroughs. What we've heard is a couple of things. On Taiwan, China was quite stern. China warned that there could be clashes and conflicts over Taiwan, you know, very strong language. And the context here is America is at the moment considering an arms deal and transfers to Taiwan, which China is obviously against. So China really put its foot down regarding that. On the flight back, Trump was interviewed by journalists on Air Force One. And he actually said that, you know, he's thinking about it. He's still considering whether the deal will go ahead or not. Trump was hoping that China would purchase Boeing jets. There's been no confirmation on that. China's agreed to buy US beef, US agriculture. However, unfettered access to rare earths, AI coordination, the reopening of the Straits of Hormuz, these were really left on the table for another time. So in the end, I would say what came out of these talks was we started to talk and let's continue talking. So in a way, they've vaguely agreed to meet at some other point in time. And despite all the grand proposals of what might come out of it, nothing major has really come out of it. I would still say, look, we're only a couple of days after this visit. There's a good possibility that more details will come out later. But from the way things are looking at the moment, there's been no major breakthroughs as such.
Unlike Trump's trip to the Middle East last year, where he got a few trillion and a jet out of it, in comparison to that, it doesn't seem to be the same. In terms of China, US, you know, great battle. Where do you think it currently stands?
So this is really the key political or geopolitical event of our time. This great power competition between China and America. You have the rising power, China, challenging the current sitting power that's been there for about 70 years. It's not looking good for America. The Iran war has got America bogged down. The Iran war was only supposed to last for 4 days. decapitate the regime, you take out key personnel, you take out the infrastructure, and the regime comes begging and the war's over like it was in Venezuela. That hasn't happened. We're 10 weeks through now, and actually an end to that war isn't looking good at all. What you're finding between China and America is the competition is taking place on the economic side, on the military side, and even on the political track. So although what we saw was diplomacy in China, the battle between them is occurring on all fronts. And if you look at all these areas, economic, military, political, China now has the resources and the capabilities to stand up against America, and it is on all these fronts. Everything America has, from technology, semiconductors, a large military aircraft carriers, China has the equivalent, or is close to the point where it's going to have all of these in significant capabilities so it can stand up against America. So this is why Trump started this trade battle. This is why Biden contributed towards it as well. This is why, if you take your mind back to Obama, he said, we're going to move 60% of our military to the South China Sea. So as far as this great power battle currently stands, America really has more to prove. You've got a battle going on in Iran. You've got a battle going on in Ukraine. And the American outcome isn't looking very, very strong. China really isn't involved in any wars per se. It doesn't have troops deployed across the world. So it doesn't have the obligations like America has. So at the moment, no, America's not looking very strong. And in fact, I would even argue some of the actions Trump's done has potentially made things even worse for the US.
I'd argue, why is China not actually taking advantage of the situation that, and the position that America's in? Why hasn't it taken over Taiwan?
So what you find with China, this is historical, it's cultural. They play the long game. They take their time. They do things when they certain. This is why, even if you look at America, even its approach, it's not started a war against China. It's not directly and openly supported proxies against China. This is going to be a slow grind because this isn't Iraq, Afghanistan, or Venezuela. You're dealing with China. A great power who's come a long way. So they can actually come back on most things America throws at it. So regarding Taiwan, you've got this small island, which is, 120 miles off the mainland China. And China knows that really when they try to reunify with Taiwan, they're not just fighting Taiwan, they're fighting America. So you want to make sure when you do this is, you're certain you can win. You have all the capabilities in place. And they understand you're not just dealing with America. You're dealing with, you're not just dealing with Taiwan. You're dealing with America as well. So really, any war with Taiwan, they got to prepare for an American involvement in this war. So really, they should only really do this when they are certain they have all the capabilities in place. From an economic perspective, from a social perspective, Taiwan is more or less integrated to China. All the semiconductors they make mostly go to China. The only thing really left is political, which is this island is not unified. And, you know, in many ways, America would prefer Taiwan become the Israel of the Far East, become the forward base, an open post for America. So I don't think we should necessarily view China not taking over Taiwan as a sign of weakness. What China is doing is waiting for the right time. And if America's bogged down with multiple issues, then that actually opens up a door of opportunity for China.
Okay, let's move on to something a bit local. The UK seems to be in chaos again. With the recent local election results, it seems like the Prime Minister's days are numbered. By the time that this podcast goes out, he may have been dethroned. Why is the UK now in a permanent political crisis?
So just 2 years ago, the Labour Party, they won a landslide victory after 14 years of a Tory government. After 14 years of austerity, people had just had enough and they just completely threw them out of the office and Labour was the alternative. But last week, the Labour Party in just 2 years, they actually lost most of their councillors. And the main problem really is people just feel we had 14 years of austerity, we've had 2 years of Labour and nothing's really changed. You see, the Labour Party, they did a U-turn on a number of their policies. They said they're going to nationalise the railways. They didn't because the railways are in a really bad state. They increased national insurance, which is a tax in the UK, and they promised in their manifesto that they won't increase taxes. So the main problem people have with the Labour Party is our lives haven't changed. Our economic situation hasn't changed. The amount of money I have in my pocket, the wage increases that I would prefer, none of that's actually changed. So what's really happened is we've had a change of faces in government, but our reality hasn't actually changed. And that's actually the number one issue. And that's why people turn against Labour. And it's quite a resounding message. Around 5,000 councillor positions were up for grabs. You had mayors in about 7 cities, and the parliaments of Wales and Scotland were all up for grabs. And Labour lost thousands and thousands of councillors, even in areas that have been under their authority for a very, very long time. So this is really a massive resounding message from the public. And it's shocking that it's only just happened in 2 years. This is the party that won a landslide victory only 2 years ago. Within 2 years, they performed so poorly, people just had enough.
The parties that did do quite well was Reform. Do you think that they'll win the next election?
So Reform is built on a populist platform. They have one policy, which is that dealing with immigration will get us to the utopia. Immigration is the source of all our problems in the UK, and successive governments not dealing with immigration has caused the problems. And Reform are the only party that will, they're talking about re-immigration, which is actually forcing people to leave the country. Now, the reason why they're doing well isn't just the platform. Mainstream parties across Europe are just no longer trusted. The centrist parties that have for long dominated the political scene in France, in Germany, in Italy, in the UK, they're just no longer trusted. They pay lip service to the demands of the people. They say they're about the working class, but they actually don't deliver. So what you find is this is why people are turning to unconventional individuals. They're turning to unconventional parties. This is why right-wing parties are very popular in the key European country. This is why a former reality TV star like Donald Trump can be in power. This is why a cricketer in Pakistan can be the leader. This is why an actor who plays the president in his drama becomes the real president in Ukraine. Now, the UK was quite...
Canadian, by the way.
Yeah, comedian. So what you're finding, though, however, I would say, I mean, you mentioned, can they win the... So, you know, the elections a week or so ago were for local elections. But in most European countries, local elections is how people teach a lesson to the ruling party. So can Reform win the next election? Now, there are significant challenges for smaller marginal parties to win the election in the UK. So in the UK, you know, you have two parties. You have the Conservative Party, who are the party of capital, and then you have the Labour Party, who apparently were the party of the working class. They've dominated the political scene, and only very few times have we had coalition governments in the UK. In the UK, you have a first-past-the-post system. As long as you win the majority of seats, you take the whole seat. Yeah, it's not proportional representation. But smaller parties don't have a good history. The system is really against them in this country. And what we find is in specific areas, you had the Iraq war, people turned against the mainstream parties. They supported the Respect Party, but the Respect Party wasn't able to turn that into success at a national level. So I think we need to wait and see. Just because people voted for Reform in the council elections doesn't necessarily mean that will translate into success at the national elections. And I say that because history shows us that smaller parties struggle at a national level. Now, the Reform Party, there's 650 seats in the UK at the national election. They don't even have enough candidates. They don't even have enough finance for that. So what you find, a smaller party, they usually focus on a few areas where they do well at a council level to try and become the MP there. This is why the Liberal Democrats, this is why other parties have struggled really to do well at a national level. So I think we need to wait and see. However, you can see Reform has tapped into a sentiment of the people. People feel the system's not working for them. The parties aren't listening to them. And they're listening to Reform that the problem is down to immigration. And that's why they did well at the council level. But I think, you know, we've got 2 years now. Reform has taken over a lot of councils. They already, five of the councils have had to step down because tweets have surfaced on social media about racist comments by them in the past. And even before this election, there was one area Reform were running and they did a really bad job where the Reform leader actually resigned. So it's possible that Reform do so poorly at a council level that people return back to the national parties, the mainstream parties, in 2 years' time. So definitely something to watch, and something we'll be watching at the Geopolity as well.
The irony is the immigration policy is, 6 pages in a PDF? So that's quite interesting in itself, isn't it? Final question on this topic. Is the UK now ungovernable?
So this seems to be the headline at the moment. The results from the local council, this is what they're saying now, that the UK is becoming really, really difficult to govern. And they're saying that if we have coalition governments, that's going to make things even more difficult. There is a problem with this term because we're having the mainstream parties do badly, it makes it out that the people are the problem, that the people have become so fractious, how are you going to govern them? And that's actually not the case. The problem is actually the politicians, the problem is the political class. And the problem is that they don't represent the masses when they come to power. They say we're about the working class to get their vote. Once they're in power, they are not there to represent the working class or the masses. They're there to represent the 1%. And reform is really about representing the 1%. That's why they've actually done well. And what you find is this 1%, these are your rich, these are your billionaires. So if you take reform as an example, who's done really well, reform is overall financed by billionaires who want financial reform in the UK. And they're the ones that have been funding reform. They're the ones who have been funding GB News, which is the Fox News of the UK, which is really a propaganda channel for reform. And these are the guys that have actually been funding them. And you find, you know, in the past, we've had Rupert Murdoch and these guys fund the Labour Party, fund the Tories. So when these political parties come into power, they are going to serve whoever funded them. They're going to serve the 1%. And then what it happens is the politicians now have to work out, how are you going to serve the 1%, but still come across as you represent the masses? And this is actually the fundamental problem. It was some of these 1% who wanted the UK to leave the EU. So not all the 1%, some of the 1% wanted the UK to leave the EU because they were not happy with the direction the EU was going when it came to finance, when it came to financial regulation. So by taking the UK out of the EU, the UK has got the City of London, which is the financial hub for the world. So, you know, this is actually the fundamental problem in the UK. The politicians are not there to represent the masses. Their job is, how do we keep the masses on side? And the way reform has done that is we're going to be anti-immigration. So if you're Labour or if you're the Tory party, the only way you're going to win the votes of the masses when they turn into reform is you're going to have to go even more to the right. So I would say reform is as much part of the system as the Labour and the Tories. What reform are doing is they are using this populist platform that immigration is a problem to take the people in one direction. But the reality is the mainstream parties have the capacity, have the resources, and have the numbers to actually run the country. And they do the same thing. So reform, Labour, Tories, they're just different sides of the same coin. They may talk different, but they serve the 1%. So the reason why the UK is ungovernable is because the politicians don't represent the people. They represent the 1%. That is the fundamental problem.
Right. Moving on to our last subject, the Russia-Ukraine war. On the 9th of May, World War II commemorations in Russia were scaled back massively as Ukraine had recently struck critical infrastructure. Now, the Western media are once again arguing that the war is at a major juncture. Is that really the case, Adnan?
We analysed the Ukraine war at the end of 2025 in Strategic Estimate 2026. And then on the four-year anniversary in February, we analysed the war again. And our conclusion on both of these occasions were that Russia's on top after 4 years. Russia had a really bad start to the war. However, it adapted. It restructured and it was basically on top. And what you find was Trump had began talks with Russia and he was actually telling Ukraine, look, you need to give up territory in the talks. If that's what ends the war, you need to do that. But what we find is Russia dragged his feet in these talks with Ukraine and with Trump because their view was if we're winning, we should take more territory. Why go into negotiation now when we're in the winning position? So next month in June, the Ukraine war would have been longer than World War One. That's how long it's actually been going on. Now, what's changed since we last sat down and talked about Ukraine is Ukraine and the Ukrainian forces, they've been targeting infrastructure deep in Russia. Ukraine now is the most advanced manufacturer of drones. In the Middle East now, they're all interested in Ukrainian drones. And Ukraine obviously doesn't have the resources Russia has. So what they've concluded is if we can carry out drone strikes deep into Russia, if we can target their energy infrastructure, and hurt Russians in that way, it will be difficult for Putin to continue with this war. Now, Russia struggled to deal with these drones that go deep into Russia. At the end of the day, these drones are small. You can produce them en masse. And if you send loads of them, how many can you actually take down? And this is the struggle the Gulf countries and Israel and America have had when it comes to Iran. A few weeks ago, Ukraine targeted Russia's energy infrastructure in the Baltics. And on one particular week, they took out 40%, nearly half of Russia's energy export capacity. So what's changed is Ukraine now has been able to, and it continues to strike deep into Russia. And this is causing some issues. Now, will this change the battlefield reality? I don't think it will. The battlefield reality is from the north of Ukraine, 800 miles to the south, you've got a front line there where Russia is poking and pushing along this line. Russia has got a bigger population. It's got more resources. It's been throwing this at Ukraine. The Ukrainians now are trying to hold that line to make sure the Russians don't get through. And the longer this goes on, it's taking up more and more resources, it's taking up more and more lives, and Russia just has more of everything compared to Ukraine. So that's where we are now. Because these are quite spectacular attacks, because they look good on a video, the Europeans are really throwing this up, that look, Ukraine now is in a strong position. And I would say, look, the last 4 years, we've heard this many times. We've heard so many times that Ukraine does a successful incursion, and look at it, the war's actually changing. So I think we have to see, but since 2 months ago, when we looked at the anniversary of this Ukraine war, apart from the attacks deep into Russia, the battlefield reality hasn't actually physically changed.
But how does Ukraine win the overall war?
So there's two ways really for Ukraine to win. One is Russia calls it a day. Russia decides, you know, we've got enough territory now, or they decide we just don't want to do this anymore. We've got bigger priorities. So that's one way they can win. I mean, if, for example, the regime was to collapse in Moscow, if something other big was to happen, then Ukraine is no longer a priority. So that's one way this could end. The other way, and probably the way things are, is Ukraine just needs lots and lots of external support. It needs the arms to keep coming from Europe and America, the funding to keep coming, the political cover to keep coming. That's what has been happening for 4 years. The only problem now is Trump. What Trump is telling Zelensky is you need to end this war, and the way to end the war is you're going to have to give up territory. So the support from the West, yeah, is a bit 50-50, it's a bit up and down. However, if the support continues, then they can drain Russia over the long term. It means the war will go on for a long period of time. So these are the only ways I can see Ukraine winning. I can't see any other way.
And how does the US win in this situation?
So the way the US wins is if they continue to supply Ukraine and it keeps Ukraine in the battle. So really, Ukraine has stayed in the battle because of American support fundamentally. So you're looking at, you know, tanks, arms, but finance especially. So as long as they keep doing that, Ukraine can stay in the war. However, what you're finding is that's not the Trump position. Trump actually keeps humiliating Ukraine. He keeps putting pressure on them to actually agree. At the moment, because Trump's eyes are on the Middle East, it's on Iran, he's not being able to give attention to this. That's why the war's still continuing. And the Europeans are not reliable partners. The Europeans have got their own economic issues. They've got their own security issues. So in the long run, Ukraine really can't rely on the West. So if the opposite happens, where America remains with its support, it remains committed to Ukraine, then yeah, potentially Ukraine could win. And if Ukraine wins, America wins.
Okay, Adnan, final question. How does Russia win in this situation then?
So the way Russia wins is a lot of what it's doing at the moment is they need to overstretch Ukraine and make it impossible for them to continue in the war. For Ukraine to stay in the war now, they need troops. They need to supply these troops. They need equipment. And for that, they need equipment coming from the West, and they need finance coming from the West. So the longer Russia drags this out, the longer they keep them holding on the front line, that will just take up more and more and suck in more and more resources. And in that sense, that's how they could defeat Ukraine. Keep in mind, Ukraine always wins wars by throwing lots of troops at the wall and draining the enemy. This is how they won in Chechnya, and this is how they defeated the Nazis. And this costs a lot of Russian lives, but Russia doesn't fight the way the West does, where you carry out a major strike, you carry out a decapitation strike, you strike the center of gravity in the enemy, so the war's over very quickly. That requires very sophisticated weaponry. It requires a lot of intelligence. That is just not how Russia fights its wars. Russia fights its wars by draining you. But Russia fights its wars effectively by saying is we've got more soldiers than you've got bullets. That's how they're going to win. So that makes the war very bloody. It requires lots of troops from the Russian perspective. It requires a lot of troops to go and die as well. And that is effectively the war Russia's fighting.
Adnan, thank you very much for your time today, as ever. To our listeners, if you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com, which is all one word. You can also learn more about other issues by accessing our website, where you will find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I've been Imran. Thank you for listening. Thank you.